KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
To Metro. Also, about 2 years ago, Metro started charging a $20 car tab fee. The thing is that car tab fee is temporary. It's due to expire next year. So Metro's looking for a couple of what it calls new funding tools. Those new funding tools include a 1.5 motor vehicle excise tax. That would be a new tax that's based on the value of your car. And Metro says it could cost the owner of an average car somewhere between $50 and $80.
That new tax is far from a done deal. First, the state legislature would need to approve it. Then it would go to King County officials, and it would probably need to be approved by voters. The King County Council is hosting a rare public meeting about the possible bus cuts at Union Station this afternoon. That meeting starts at 3:30. Normally, the county council meets at the county courthouse, but the last time this subject came up, more than 1,000 people showed up, and the line stretched for about a block. Justices on the Washington Supreme Court today are considering whether a $100 million verdict against the state should be allowed to stand. The money was awarded to some 22,000 home care workers who were shortchanged by a state rule that was in effect from 2003 to 2007. Lawyers for the state want the justices to reverse the verdict. Lawyers for the workers have filed a cross appeal and say that the people who received care should also have been awarded money. This is KUOW News. I'm Jamala Henderson.
It's 52 degrees in Seattle. It's getting sunnier. Forecast says it's going to be partly sunny today with a high in the mid-60s. Support for NPR comes from IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
Support for KUOW comes from Propel Insurance.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:06. KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Susan Orlean joins us later this hour. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, the author of several books, most recently Rin Tin Tin. We're going to talk about how her natural curiosity leads her to create vivid stories about real people and animals in this case. And later this morning, a new documentary film about women military veterans. These days, threats to our national security come as much from the virtual as from armed military conflict. The federal government warns cyber attacks directed at government computer systems could cause as much damage as any bomb attack. Recently, we've seen the impact of hacking on media outlets as diverse as The Onion and NPR. What does it mean for ordinary citizens? University of Washington professor Yoshi Kono studies computer security and privacy issues and joins us this morning in the studios. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We hear a whole lot about how there are secure computer services we shouldn't worry, and then, you know, a week later they get hacked. So the big question is, how does one hack a secure server cloud computer?
That's a very good question. I think I might begin by saying that in reality, even though we hear a lot in the news about this system being secure or this system being insecure, there is no such thing as perfect security in computer science. In fact, security is all about security is not a binary, is what we like to say. In fact, that security is kind of a gradient. All systems can be secure against some adversaries, but also insecure against other adversaries. An analogy I like to give in my class is that of a piggy bank. You know, a piggy bank might be secure against my younger sibling, but not secure against the Secret Service if they wanted access.
Wow. Okay. So qualified security is what you're saying. I guess then, how does one, for example, hack Onion's Twitter account? Not that that's a secure computer necessarily, but one doesn't think about hacking. That's the most recent thing I can
think of. Yeah, there are a number of problems that arise in computer systems. One is the choice of weak passwords. This is actually a very, very big problem that can arise. If someone's password is guessable, maybe it's their birthday, maybe it's the name of a family member, maybe it's the name of their favorite book, that's a problem. Another problem can arise is that if someone uses the same password on multiple sites. So let's say I use the same password for Google, as I use for Microsoft, as I use for Twitter and various other things. If one of those systems gets compromised, then an attacker might get my password. And from that point, they might be able to obtain access to my other accounts.
So that would be, for me, the consumer. These days, we are invited to be paperless. There are a lot of good reasons for that. Sometimes it's just easier for the companies. So that goes for everything from banking to, for example, I'm the parent of a child who's going to be a freshman in college, and all of the financial aid forms are online these days.
Yep.
At the federal government level, where you know your tax return gets morphed into your FAFSA form, and people can, at the governmental level, can take all this information, which leads me to think anybody has access to that information. There's a lot of everything from your bank account to your social security number.
There's definitely a lot of information floating around. And as you point out, we are transitioning to a paperless society where more and more information is being uploaded. And at one point or another, we end up having to trust those people or those companies or those entities that are in control of our data. And I think that's part of the onus is on us as educators. So I'm at the University of Washington to help educate the broader, broader set of people that are developing these systems on how to try to appropriately secure them. But again, we need to keep in mind that there's no such thing as perfect security. And even though we try to do the best we can to protect against an attack arising, we need to put mechanisms in place to detect if an attack has occurred and mitigate it as quickly as possible.
Are we developing those sorts of systems as quickly as hackers can figure out new ways to get into the systems?
I would say that we're innovating technology at a faster rate than we are innovating, incorporating security mechanisms. And one of the things I would like to, kind of bring everyone's awareness to is the fact that although we have computers, we all know about Twitter and our computers at our desktop and the computers in the cloud, people may not realize that we have computers all around us. And so, when you get in a modern automobile, you're actually getting into a vehicle, into a thing that might have 10, 50, 100 computers inside it, or an airplane,
wow.
Or if you have a medical device, you have a computer inside your body. And all these things, even though the risk might be low for compromise, they have computers, they have wireless interfaces, and we need to be thinking about the security for those technologies too.
Okay, so the first thing that happens when you list all those things, Yoshi Kono, is that I immediately freeze and think, I never want to take one step, beyond my bedroom. That it is a little paralyzing.
I think the risk today is actually incredibly small. So the risk of someone actually compromising the computer in the vehicle or in a medical device or in your children's toys is incredibly small. And I don't think anyone needs to be concerned today. But I do think that as a society, we need to be aware of these risks so that, in 10 or 15 years, when the computers are more sophisticated, we will have thought through the security implications and have defenses in place.
So this is the consumer level. Let's take it up a notch to the corporate or governmental level. Who are the hackers that are trying to get into, for example, several energy companies were hacked not that long ago? Who was trying to get that information?
Yeah, I prefer not to speculate too much about, individual cases. But I do think that it's worth pointing out that attackers can run the gamut from, foreign intelligence agencies to terrorist groups to organized crime to individuals who are kind of bored and just want to kind of explore and be creative. So there's a wide spectrum of attackers, and obviously different types of adversaries have different resources available to them and different motives, sometimes financial, sometimes political, sometimes ideological, and so on.
So there, when the president or other security officials say cybersecurity is the biggest concern, maybe more so than boots on the ground military conflict, do you think that's true, that it is as big a threat?
I don't know anything about physical war, so I can't really compare apples to, I can't really compare them
right.
Directly to each other. But I would say that that the system we've created is very fragile. I'm very fortunate that, we have, people, focusing on trying to help improve the security of these systems. But I do say that think that it is a very important thing to be aware of. And I think that consumers can do their job by kind of asking for security and privacy. And of course, the government needs to do their job by thinking holistically about what we need to do to change security and privacy.
So just in general, if we are about to launch into some other online information flow, for example, if I decide that I'm going to switch to a different kind of banking system that is totally paperless, although it's pretty much paperless now, but should I change banks, for example, what do I need to make sure when I put my money a certain place or decide that I'm going to make transactions someplace through a credit card, what do I need to know?
These are good questions. And like I said earlier, at one point you will have to be trusting them. But there are certain things that you can do. For example, you know, set up a password that is unique to that site. One other thing that I would point out is that if your audience or you haven't used it already, there's something called two-factor authentication. Google has this. Facebook has this. It's being rolled out at other places as well. What two-factor authentication does is that if I, you know, I configure it so that I'm required my phone to be with me when I log into the Google, for example. And so if I log into Google from a new computer, I'll enter my password just as before, mm-hmm. but then I'll have to actually use my phone to get an additional authentication code for just that particular instant in time. The idea being there is that if an attacker were somehow able to steal my password, like maybe I, you know, wasn't careful enough and used the same password on another site, even if an attacker stole that password, they would not be able to access my Google account or my Facebook account without my phone there with me.
It strikes me that there are so many numbers and codes to remember these days that those of us who are not as young as you will have a harder time negotiating the new world.
I think everyone has a hard time. And in reality, you know, even though I say these are the security best practices, I have to admit that I don't follow them myself all the time.
Because it takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of attention.
Exactly. It's hard to be secure all the time. And, you know, it's hard to know exactly what the risk is, though I think there is some risk.
We're talking with University of Washington's Yoshi Kono, and he studies computer security and privacy issues. I heard an interview recently on NPR about the difference between European debit cards and the kinds of magnetic strip cards that we have in the United States. And the person who was being interviewed said in Europe they use sort of individualized chips that have information that would only be mine on each card. And it led me to wonder why we don't have things like that in this country. Is it because there's too many of us?
That's a very good question about why we don't have it in this country. And,
are we just behind?
It's hard to know. I mean, people have tried to roll it out. I mean, the American Express Blue Card is a card with a little computer chip on it and so on. We definitely see it much more prevalently in Europe, though one thing I will point out is that researchers have been uncovering security flaws with the way they've been done in Europe. But I do want to bring this as an opportunity again to come back to the statement that or observation that security is not just about the cloud or my laptop. And so one of the things that attackers, criminals do like to do is they put something called a credit card skimmer on the outside of a debit credit card machine, you know, outside of the credit card payment system at a gas station or
right.
an ATM machine. And what they do is when it looks very, very authentic, but when a person puts in their credit card, it just makes a copy of the data on the mag stripe. So the attackers can then clone their own cards.
Is there any way for us to know that that's happening?
Kind of look to see if the ATM machine looks a little funny. But of course, attackers are making those pieces of little gadgets more and more kind of authentic looking.
So again, I go back to the sort of paralysis about either giving anybody information online or skimming. In fact, I believe those three guys in New York who stole a vast amount of money from ATMs. Worse, they did use a skimmer, didn't they?
I can't remember the details.
They got hundreds of thousands of dollars. So this is happening. This is a normal occurrence these days. We don't see so much bank robbers with machine guns jumping on the counter and saying, you know, put your hands up. All they have to do is make a facsimile of our card.
Yeah, it's definitely becoming easier and easier to access information online. And so one of the things that, you know, we also like to mention in computer security is that, you know, in the physical world, you know, it takes effort for me to go from one neighborhood to another neighborhood to perpetrate some sort of crime. But on the internet, we're all next door neighbors.
So your students at the University of Washington, are they working on ways to increase security measures? Is that something they do? Or are you just looking at how they take our money?
We do a lot of stuff at the University of Washington. So we work on trying to develop better ways to help educate people about computer security. So how can we help better educate future developers or the consumers about security issues? We do a lot of work on trying to understand what the vulnerabilities might be in future technologies. So for example, I mentioned automobiles. We actually purchased an automobile and, you know, tried to subject it to a number of attacks, and we uncovered some surprising things. And then, of course, we are working on defenses. For example, how can we better improve password authentication on the web?
Wow, fascinating new fields of study. Yoshi Kono is an associate professor in the University of Washington's Department of Computer Science and Engineering and also adjunct faculty in information sciences. As you heard, he studies computer security and privacy issues in their broadest sense. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Great, thank you for having me.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
It's 9:19. KUOW's Dave Beck will introduce us to the music of little-known 19th century American composer William Henry Fry in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle pediatrician Dr. Robert Pretlow, currently recruiting 30 overweight youth between ages 13 and 21 to participate in a study of a smartphone app in a self-directed weight loss program. More information and qualifying criteria at patientecare.com/study.
52 degrees in Seattle. Forecast says we're going to hit 65 this afternoon. It's going to be partly sunny. Then it's a clear sky overnight, 48 for a low, and tomorrow Wednesday showers with a high of 61. 9:20, I'm Bernard Ouellette. Susan Orlean, author of The Orchid Thief and Rin Tin Tin, joins us to talk about how she approaches her long-form nonfiction in about 10 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Last week on the program, we inaugurated what we hope will become a regular feature. We've invited music lovers, music critics to come in and share ideas to help get you out of your music listening ruts. Today, we didn't look far to find a great music lover and expert, Dave Beck, a cellist in residence at KUOW, member of the Auburn Symphony, studies music, talks about music in his off hours, which I don't know. Probably he just never sleeps. And today you are going to introduce us to a composer that I have never heard of. His name is William Henry Fry, a journalist and a composer.
Yes. How can I not love William Henry Fry, Marcy? Because he has ink on his hands and music in his heart. He was born in 1813, lived to 1864, grew up in Philadelphia, where his father was the publisher and founder of the National Gazette.
Wow.
So newspapering was the family business. But Henry, when he was a kid, William Henry would listen in on his older brother's piano lessons. And then he would go and practice the piano. So he's self-taught.
And when was this?
This was, he was born in, 1813, and a mid-19th century that he was thriving. And grew up in Philadelphia, was putting on his own shows, symphonies and operas, when he was a teenager. But again, this was all something that he did kind of on the side because newspapering was in his blood.
And so he really was a reporter first and a composer.
Oh, yes, absolutely. But the two kind of dovetailed because he became so good as a writer that he was hired by the New York Tribune to go to London and Paris for several years. And, of course, he went to opera and symphony and met Hector Berlioz, among other things.
But this sounds familiar. There are quite a few writers who have also been composers. We're going to listen to a little bit of, just so people get an idea of what William Henry Fry sounds like. And I think this is a portion of the Macbeth overture.
Right.
Well, so Dave, I'm listening to those horns and the octaves, and I'm thinking Wagnerian.
Interesting, because it was around the time that Wagner was writing. This is 1864, so Wagner had already had some operas under his belt. But what Fry is doing here, it's called the Macbeth Overture, and those trombones are supposed to represent the witches doing the double-double
with their cauldrons.
Yes, and so
it
kind of creates that ominous atmosphere. He was very enamored with Italian opera, and that often sounds like Verdi when you listen to Fry. But he had a more American accent in some other works.
And he was from Philly, working in New York, or what was? Did he have a relationship with the New York Philharmonic at all?
Well, no, not a good one. He did not have a relationship with the New York Philharmonic, and that irked him to no end. The New York Philharmonic was founded in 1842, and just was not interested in playing William Henry Fry's music, and he thought that was just criminal. maybe a little ego involved there, but also the fact they just weren't playing any American composers. They were very enamored with music coming from Europe. Then and now, that's still the problem.
I was going to say,
some things never change. But so when he was at his best, I think, is when he was writing music that actually reflected American audiences.
Well, this is couldn't be any more American. This is a piece of the Niagara.
Yes, let's bring up the music here. And Marcy, you and I are going to go on a journey towards the falls. We're in our little boat, and William Henry Frye is taking us on this journey. And you sense something is happening. We're approaching something. It's getting a little misty, and Frye brings in his brass. He brings in 11 timpani, and we round the corner, and the falls come into view.
And our boat has just tumbled over.
That's right.
11 timpani there.
Yes. I think when he was in Paris and met Berlioz, and Berlioz was dramatically expanding orchestral forces, I think that Frye was paying attention here.
Well, I know he also had some kind of, I know because you told me, that he had a relationship with the circus impresario P.T. Barnum.
Yes.
So 11 timpani and P.T. Barnum.
Spectacle.
There's something there.
Yeah. Well, Barnum, it's interesting, did a lot of promoting of opera in America.
Really?
And he would bring over great European artists and put them in American opera houses. And opera houses in those days had benches and you could get a beer and smoke a cigar and watch, you know, Jenny Lind, the Swedish Nightingale, hold forth.
That's right.
Much more eclectic and a little bit rowdy at times in opera houses.
Well, I guess if you have 11 timpani players on a stage,
right,
it's going to be loud and rowdy. Now, so these are the, you know, beautiful bucolic scenes of America, perhaps the brashness of America, but there is also a lovely holiday side to,
yes,
William Henry Frye.
Yeah, in 1853, Frye was on one of these tours sponsored by P.T. Barnum. They were called Monster Concerts.
They and were not, they like were, Monster I, Truck Rallies?
I'm not kidding you. They were called Monster Concerts. They were these big spectacles. And so Frye is composing for a group called the Julienne Orchestra, which was led by this very flamboyant Frenchman. And it was a show. And so in 1853, assuming a holiday production, he wrote a Santa Claus Symphony, which has all sorts of great scenes, including Santa, as portrayed by the bassoon, getting out of his sleigh and doing a little jaunty jig as he delivers presents here.
Wait. Is he smacking the kids as he comes down the chimney?
I'm not sure what he's up to there, but he's, hear those winds in the, the winds are blowing. It's inclement American weather on the East Coast back in 1853, and Frye is telling us about that.
I'm interested that he chose a bassoon to portray Santa.
Yes, isn't that great? Well, there were he was very in tune with the individual players of the Julienne Orchestra, and if he had a great bassoonist, he was going to write a part for them. The saxophone was a newly invented instrument, and it was the first use of the saxophone in symphonic music.
Who knew?
And that was William Henry Frye.
Well, we've come to the end of this, and here's this composer that I'm guessing many people like me have never heard of.
Nobody really knows
William Henry Frye,
and
now we all do.
This it's a Scottish orchestra that records the music. It's not even an American orchestra. So.
Well, why is it easy to find him? How do we find him?
Well, yeah, we'll have links, and it's four of his pieces are recorded on Naxos, which is a great American label, even if it's a Scottish orchestra playing, and it's worth listening to. I think that instead of doing, I mean, I love the Nutcracker, I love the Messiah, but why not do the Santa Claus Symphony, you know, this when holiday orchestra concerts roll around?
It's, well, I know that Maestro Morlot is in Europe right now, but maybe he's listening to us online, you know?
It could be.
William Henry Frye's Santa Claus Symphony. We're going to go out with another excerpt
Yes.
You want to set
and
it up
here's,
for us?
He had a great clarinetist in the orchestra that he wanted to show off, and this clarinet shows up as part of the Santa Claus festivities.
Here. So we'll leave you with Santa Claus in May. KOW's Dave Beck, thanks for coming in and introducing us to William Henry Fry.
That's the music of 19th century American composer William Henry Fry on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:30. A conversation with author Susan Orlean in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Alaska USA Federal Credit Union. For over three generations, Alaska USA members have shared the goal of helping each other get places worth going with savings accounts, loans, investments, insurance policies, and more. On the web at alaskausa.org.
A mother works to support her family, but is still made to feel guilty that she's not constantly around school.
I showed up for the preschool graduation, and they all looked at me like, who are you? And I felt like the bad mom moment. Like, he's got the Dad of the Year award, and I'm sitting on the sidelines a little bit.
When women's roles change and society's expectations do not, on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow on KUOW's Morning News Magazine, which airs from 4 to 9 a.m.
Support for KUOW comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
52 degrees in Seattle. Forecast says it's going to be partly sunny today with a high of 65, then showers return tomorrow with a high of 61. We'll get a more detailed weather forecast for the week and a hike to match the week's forecast in 20 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. In my mind, Susan Orlean has the dream job. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, where she covers what the magazine calls American culture, which could be anything, I think. She's written books about travels, about the people she's met, about an obsessive horticulturalist, and most recently about the legendary canine TV and film star Rin Tin Tin, actually many Rin Tin Tins. Susan Orlean joins me in the studio today. Welcome back to Seattle.
It's my pleasure to be here.
I was reading on the official website of yours that you always wanted to write long pieces about people who do interesting things, but when you went to the University of Michigan, there wasn't any kind of major in writing things about interesting people who do things.
Right. This was actually... Michigan, in particular, a great school, but it had one track when it came to being a writer of nonfiction, which was a straight journalism background. And it never interested me. I took one journalism class. I sat in one or two sessions and dropped out.
Wow. Yeah. So, but nevertheless, you did go into journalism. Sort of.
I did. I got very lucky. I mean, I majored in English, very traditional English literature, moved to Portland, so right around the corner, the other city in the Northwest.
The smaller one.
And I really didn't know how I could do this job that seemed, there was no clear career path to this dream job that I had in mind. So I had actually, at that point, acceded to my parents' wishes that I go to law school. And I had just said, excuse me, I'm a little hoarse today. I said, just give me a year, and then I'll go to law school. Even though my interest in being a lawyer was less than zero. But it seemed like that was what people with English degrees, I mean, frequently that's what people with English degrees did. I lucked into a job at a tiny little startup magazine. My qualifications were that I just came to the interview and I said, you have to give me this job. You have to. I I'll do it for free. I just, please let me work here. The minute I started writing, I knew it was what I wanted to do.
You were covering the county. This was the Willamette Weekly that you worked for. You were covering the county, and you were turning in stories that were not quite, I think, what your editors had envisioned when they said, you know, Susan Orlean, cover the county.
Right. I think they assumed I'd be doing stories about zoning ordinances and road repair. And my first story on the beat was a piece about amyl nitrite. And that suddenly was appearing in shops all over. And it was kind of the new over-the-counter high. My editor read it. He said, I really like the story, but what does it have to do with the county? And I said, well, it's taking place in the county. So that was the beginning of the end of my life as a beat reporter. At some point soon thereafter, he said to me, just go do the stories that you're interested in.
So the New Yorker calls your beat American culture, which I imagine is whatever you latch onto. Am I wrong?
It's right. And I feel very, very lucky to have that kind of freedom. I think coming up with story ideas is a huge piece of my job. And that is to find the stories that are not the predictable, obvious stories, but the ones that aren't purposefully obscure or unknown, but stories that, to me, jump out and reveal something actually very big, even if it's just that they reveal something about human nature. And those are stories that I come up with that I suppose nominally fall into this category of American culture.
Well, most recently, you've written about your treadmill desk. I think that's what it's called, treadmill desk. And this is a desk that essentially you're on a treadmill while you're working, right?
Right, yeah. And this was a short, very fun piece that actually the magazine had come to me and said, we're doing an issue about innovation, and we've heard that you have a treadmill desk. And I said, well, I do. In fact, I'm on it right now as we're talking. And so my editor said, can you write just a little piece about it? And it was actually a lot of fun to do. And for the record, I did write it while I was on my treadmill desk, which I felt was meant that it was doubly determined.
We're talking with writer Susan Orlean, and I'm imagining writing on a treadmill desk the same way as, you know, you rub your stomach and pat your head at the same time.
I know.
Well,
there are people who probably would fall off, and I'm happy to say I'm not one of those people. It is less of an intellectual undertaking than you might think. The desk is set up so that you walk and you very quickly forget that you're walking and you just do your work. And I love it. I really love it. And this is my second piece that I've written while walking at my desk. This could be my imagination, but in both cases, I was unusually fluid as I was writing. And I wonder whether it's because, you know, you get a lot of nervous energy when you're sitting still. Mm-hmm. And there have been times when I notice that if I'm sitting at a desk and I'm jiggling my legs and I'm tapping the keyboard and I'm chewing gum and I'm sort of burning up a lot of energy.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering also if it was a slow endorphin seep. You know, you're not walking fast enough that you're out of breath when you're doing this.
Right.
But when you are moving, you know, if you are a runner, so and you get an endorphin high.
Absolutely. And it has been studied enough to know that, for instance, people who hold meetings while they're walking are more productive for many reasons, including the fact that they're not sitting face to face in a sort of confrontational way. But also your body, there's something else is going on when you're walking.
I wonder if that's why all those executives go out to the golf course. That just stuck in my head. You wrote in your book,
a golfing desk. That's a new innovation.
I think that would be very, very hard.
Very popular.
For me in particular. But it's an interesting idea. You wrote in the Rin Tin Tin book that the stuff that stays with us and manages to outlive its limits is what drew me to this story. And it's what I wonder about. Is that the basis of anything that you really delve into on this long form level?
Absolutely. I think what my greater curiosity is could be just that real question of how do we manage this mysterious thing called life? How do we figure out what to do with our time and our thoughts and our hearts? What do we care about? What do we make matter? And what are the stories that drive us? And that ends up being the sort of deeper connection I have with the subjects that I choose.
Well, this book is called Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend, but it's, to my mind, as much about Lee Duncan, who was the discoverer of this little puppy in, I think it was a barn, right, in World War I in France, and, you know, a bunch of puppies. He took two of these puppies home. But so it's about all the Rin Tin Tins, because there were many of them. But it's as much about this man.
Absolutely.
I mean, you could have called it, you know, Lee Duncan.
Yeah. And part of what was fascinating to me is how invisible he was, in spite of having created this international icon that literally everybody around the world knew of. And Lee remained very much in the background, he really sublimated his own need for attention in the interest of promoting the fame of Rin Tin Tin, and that fascinated me.
It was about promoting the fame of his dog, but at some point, I'm not sure if it was you or he, called Rin Tin Tin the love of his life.
Absolutely. And there was something both remarkable and also a little heartbreaking, because he was married and he has a child.
Right? He was married twice.
Yeah. And I would say that some of what fascinated me was that he never really connected with another person, that his emotions were channeled totally to this connection with the dog. And he was a pretty solitary man. And what he found, what connection he found in a sense of being intimate, was just with Rin Tin Tin.
Rin Tin Tin the first.
The first.
Because there were many Rin Tin Tins. Some of them might not have been related to the original Rin Tin Tin. That's part of your quest. But it was that first dog. I think he had subsequent close relationships with other of the dogs. But it was that first puppy that that was the love of his life.
Well, when you think about the circumstances, he was a lonely kid, grew up partly in an orphanage, partly on a huge ranch in Southern California, abandoned by his father when he was a child, goes to war, World War I. He enlists because he wanted to learn how to fly, and, you know, had never traveled anywhere, had never been anywhere, suddenly is in what would arguably be considered the most brutal war the world has ever known. You know, just the shock of it. The sort of closeness of battle in World War I, I think, is quite different even from what we see in modern warfare.
Right.
I mean, this was hand-to-hand combat. Right. Horrible circumstances. His unit was being decimated not only by combat, by the flu, which there was a huge epidemic of flu. Just a nightmare. In the middle of this, and he had always loved dogs, he finds these puppies. So I think the context makes you understand it's not just that he's this odd, sort of emotionally deformed person, but rather in those extreme circumstances, surrounded by death, a kid who always had been lonely, who always had loved animals, finds these puppies. And that almost saves him. The remainder of the war, he just focused on keeping these puppies alive.
We're talking with writer Susan Orlean. Her most recent book is about Lee Duncan and Rin Tin Tin. And you set off exploring Rin Tin Tin. I imagine you didn't know about Lee Duncan. And it leads me to wonder whether if it had been just sort of a promoter sort of guy, a crass person, that you would have spent 10 years of your life pursuing this story.
Never. And that was part of what was so interesting, is this was a story that, you know, I was fascinated by Rin Tin Tin because I remembered him from my childhood. I was in love with German Shepherds when I was a kid because of Rin Tin Tin. Mm-hmm. And then when I discovered, purely accidentally, that he had been a real dog, not born in the 1950s, which was when the TV show ran, but born in 1918, and I thought, what? This is crazy. Lee's story was so much more interesting than, for instance, Lassie, who was owned by a dog trainer who had been trained for the movies, who, you know, that, of course, it's an interesting story. But there wasn't this organic tale of, you know, a kid finds a dog and then almost stumbled into Hollywood with him. Really, this was not a commercial project of let me train a dog for the movies, but rather this was my pet dog that I am intimately bonded with, and he's so smart. I wonder if, I don't know, maybe I could get a job because I have no job otherwise. Maybe I could get him into the movies. I'll go knocking on studio doors. So his story and the arc of how it happened was so interesting and so unexpected. And I really think that had it not been that story, it wouldn't have ended up being a book.
I'm just imagining you pitching this to a book editor. I'm going to write this long book about Rin Tin Tin, and I'm going to spend a decade tracking down.
You never say that when you're pitching a book. You say, I think it'll be really quick. I think I'll be able to have it for you in a year. And then on the 11th month, you say, you know, actually, there's a little more there. Part of it was, honestly, I kept finding more material. As I began the book, I had no idea that I would find in Riverside, California, 14 huge file boxes of Lee Duncan's papers.
These were in a storage unit that was it his daughter that had the key? A relative had it.
That was Burt Leonard.
Burt Leonard's key.
Lee's material was all being thrown out, and somebody saw it as it was being put in a dumpster and said, wait a minute, that doesn't seem right. This is part of my memories of childhood. It seems like let's save these papers. And she collected them and gave them to the museum in Riverside. But they had basically sat there more or less unnoticed for many, many years.
It seems like it would take a particular kind of personality to do this sort of stalking of the facts. Would you call yourself sort of obsessive, disciplined? How do you describe what it is that it takes to keep going on a story like this?
That's a very good question. There's a kind of determination, I guess, and a drive. And it was very interesting when I was working on The Orchid Thief and I was writing very, very directly about the idea of obsession mm-hmm. and a kind of passion that I found very peculiar. And yet it dawned on me, and it was sort of the big flip in the book, was suddenly thinking, but I'm exactly the same way. Mm-hmm. I look at this as very odd, like, why would anybody be so obsessed with an orchid? Why would someone be so obsessed with Rin Tin Tin? And yet, of course, the great irony is that the entire process of pursuing these stories requires a similar sort of obsession. And in the case of The Orchid Thief, one thing I marveled over is how John LaRoche, the main character mm-hmm. in the book, had an alarming ability to focus intensely on something, be wildly passionate about it, and then be done. Just turn it off, walk away, go on to the next passion. And I thought, how weird. How could anybody do that? Well, of course, the great surprise, you know, the joke was on me because that is the nature of being a writer. You are obsessed and focused with a subject, and then you finish and you move on.
You have a elementary school-aged child now, which you didn't for most of your career.
Right.
And how does that play into the kind of focus that you need to be peeking through dusty archives in the Riverside Museum or going to weird storage units where you might get conked on the head because it's dark and scary?
It's huge. It's huge. And it's something that I hadn't really anticipated. I naively assumed that I would have a kid and then, you know, the next day sort of go back to work. Wrong on every account, not only in the mere fact of the amount of time being a parent requires, but the ability to say, I'm going to go dive into these archives and I'll emerge in a week, a month, you know, you name it. That ability to surrender entirely to a story just doesn't exist anymore. And that, you know, a lot of people, there's a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of finger-pointing about why there aren't more women doing long-form nonfiction. And call me a contrarian, but the fact is it's a very hard choice of careers if you're a parent. And being a mother, I think, is different from being a father.
Mm-hmm.
And this is maybe treading on controversial territory, but I think it's a very difficult thing when you're a mother to say, I'm going to go away for 3 weeks because I'm digging into archives. I'll see you in 3 weeks. I now, first of all, I think about stories before I opt into them and try to think, how much travel will this take? How much time will it take? How much of that kind of focus will it require versus I want to be a good parent. I want to, you know, and I miss my kid mm-hmm. and I want to be with him. I'm working on a new book, and part of the pleasure of it is that I'm living in Los Angeles right now and the book is in LA. There's some amount of travel I'll have to do, but the bulk of it is in LA. And I thought, wow, I can actually do this and still have a normal life. It's a huge problem. And as much as we love the idea of having equality in opportunity, the reality of what it feels like day to day to be a mother and to have work that requires a kind of surrender of yourself. Nobody has solved that problem, and I don't know that they ever will.
It won't be in my lifetime, I don't think.
Yeah.
We'll look forward open-endedly to that next book. Susan Orlean is a staff writer for New Yorker magazine. Her most recent book is called Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend, which I believe is out in paperback. And she's going to be speaking tonight at 7:30 at Benaroya Hall in downtown Seattle. It's part of the Seattle Arts and Lecture Series. It's wonderful to have you here again.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. This is Weekday. Well, the clouds and more May-like weather have returned to the central Puget Sound, but that doesn't mean you have to give up all hopes of getting outside. Michael Fagan joins us, as he does most Tuesdays. And Michael, you have a suggestion for people who just have to have sun, correct?
That's right. This is almost guaranteed sun going out towards Ellensburg. We're suggesting the Puget Energy Wind Farm, and now is this next week to 10 days is a perfect time to go for a couple reasons. The main reason is there's wildflowers out there, and that's pretty special when you could walk amongst the sagebrush and see some very unique flowers. There's this hedgehog cactus. I have a picture of it on my blog. There's lupine and a lot more flowers. And as far as the weather, weather will be sunny all over the region today, and today will be the nicest day. And then for the Seattle area, chance of rain on and off Wednesday through Sunday. But out by Ellensburg by the wind farm, it should be dry. And what's neat about going out to the wind farm is people assume that the wind turbines are noisy. They're not. They're very quiet. And what's also nice, when you get to the ridgetop of the wind farm, you can see Mount Rainier, Mount Adams, and if it's real clear, perhaps even Mount Hood. So it's a special place. Now, the thing you do need to realize, you have to check in at the visitor center.
I was just going to ask you. Yeah, I was going to ask you. This is private property, right?
It is private, and there's some government property adjacent to it. And all Puget Energy asks is you fill out a form abiding by the rules and so forth. So once you check in at the visitor center, you get your permit, and it's good for a year, so you can hike around at your leisure. They give you maps. So, yeah, like I said, you just need to sign the permit. And they're open 7 days a week, 9 to 5:30. So you can get your permit and head off and enjoy. Now, the hikes, there are several real nice trails. There is as short as a total of 5 miles. Or if you really get ambitious, there's some backcountry roads you can take and trails. Just make sure you have a GPS if you're going to go off trail. So there's quite a bit to do there. So, again, I just talked to the folks over there, and they said another week to 10 days the flowers will be prime. And the weather this next several days is going to be pretty nice over there, highs about 70 degrees. If you wait too much into the summer, you could be looking at the upper 90s, that type of temperature.
How long a drive from Seattle?
I'd say about an hour and 20 minutes once you're on I-90.
And then it's immediately, once you stop and register, it's immediately hikeable, or do you have to hike in?
Right. So you, and I have the driving directions on my blog, as well as the link to Puget Energy. But basically, once you go into the visitor center, you park right there, get your permit, and you can start wandering around. So it's not really a bad drive. Like I said, about an hour and 20 minutes if you, once you're on I-90 outside of Seattle. So good trip for the next week or so.
Especially if you want to get out of the overcast. Michael Fagan is with West Coast Weather LLC. His blog, Fagan's Weather World, gives us good hikes to match the weekend weather forecast. And you can find that blog at hikewashington.net. And today, best day for the Puget Sound region for the coming 3 or 4, right? This is going to be the driest?
Right. And it's not to say Wednesday through Sunday is going to be constantly rain. Just rain on and off, but if you're looking to maximize the vitamin D ratio, today's the day to do that.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Michael. Appreciate
sure,
your time.
By the way, at the wind farm, you should bring a windbreaker
because it's windy.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much. Enjoy the weekend. Bet. Bye-bye. And now, the sound of the day. Okay, you probably have heard that sound. It's robins chirping, and there is a caw of a crow in the background. This is sent to us by listener Noel. says the sound robins make this a call at dawn and dusk, and they're unique to those times of day. These birds sound different other times of day. It's a fairly complex musical composition, according to Noel's grandmother. This call is when they're calling for rain.
Huh.
I have no idea. Did they check with the robins?
Is the morning and the evening call the same call? Or
they're not. They're different. And I only know that because I live in the woods. And so I hear the robins in the morning and the evening. And I'm thinking this is the evening call. But it's nice. Well, we're curious whether you're listening to robins or frogs or dripping ale. What do you hear? Record 30 seconds of that sound, and you can send it to us along with the story behind the sound. Email it to weekday@kuow.org, and be sure that you include sound of the day in the subject line. That's beautiful. It makes me want to go outside, even when it's a little bit rainy, Bernard. We're going to talk about the public schools in Seattle coming up. Also going to talk a little bit of gardening for those who want to get outside, so stay with us for the next
hour.
Coming
up this hour. Thanks, Marcy. Listening to those birds made me think of a news story we're going to hear coming up here. A new study has found that urban stresses can cause birds to abandon their eggs. That's in the newscast in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Children's. Its new cancer, critical, and emergency care expansion, nicknamed Building Hope, provides more beds, advanced technology, and a healing...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.